called the brethren. And he's going to tell you something about his trip and about a little while he's going to go to Australia. He's going to visit Brisbane, Melbourne, and also he might visit. Do I have everything here? Yeah. Okay.
Well, good morning, brethren. Being chairman's tough. Before we get started, we wanted to once again bring the love of your brethren in Orlando. And I spoke with my wife, Sister Cheryl, yesterday evening, and she sent special love. As Brother Dom alluded, our plans next month, Lord willing, is to go on a business trip to Australia. And of course, we're going to also be about the Lord's business as well. We plan to visit with the class in Melbourne and the class in Brisbane. And hopefully the brethren from Gympie can come down as well. We got to fellowship with some of these brethren at International Convention, and so we just had a preview of sweet fellowship to come. So we're looking forward to that. And also, as I indicated in my earlier talk, next week is the Orlando Convention, and I would really like to take the love of both this convention to both Orlando and to travels in Australia. So I have a unanimous consent. They were of one consent. We also wanted to bring special love from all of the brethren in Orlando, and for those of you who know Joyce and Larry Young, Joyce has gone through a recent accident that could have been very traumatic and, if not fatal. She was hit by a 14-ton tow truck while dead stopped, and it was going 45 miles an hour. So she went through a period, and she's got her neck brace off, and the bruises are starting to fade, and she's up and about. So for those of you that were asking, she's strong in the spirit and getting stronger in the body. Brother Dom asked me if I would re-give the definition of humility that I presented yesterday from a dear sister, Sister Amy Lloyd, who's 96, 97 years old now and in a nursing home, but it's something that stuck with me, and so we'll do that before we get started, because I know some of the brethren were not here. Her definition of humility was not thinking too highly of yourself, not thinking too lowly of yourself, mostly just not thinking of yourself. And so we offer that.
Thank you.
You know, all of the brethren have opportunities for service, and we've seen many of those opportunities here from doing the recording and the sound, which is something I do in our convention, and I have great respect for everyone that does, to doing the videotaping, to running the book table, to arranging the motel and all the accommodations. And you know, yesterday evening, I think we had a very special treat here in having that very wonderful camp presentation. Where do I sign up for camp? That's all I could say. That was wonderful. And you know, it points out the fact, as the Apostle Paul stated as well, that all of us have opportunities for service. Some are eloquent speakers. Some are wonderful at witnessing. Obviously, some are wonderful in the musical and presentation arena. And all of these are to the glory of God. So we appreciate that very much. Let me give you a technical introduction of myself and kind of a little background on this talk. This is a talk that you may have heard on tape. It's about the year 2000 probably. And you know, this summer at General Convention, my daughter came to me and said, well, what are you going to talk on? And I actually had a different subject. Brother Joseph Panucci covered it wonderfully with the exact same title immediately before my talk. So I switched back to a talk we've entitled, Tell the Brethren. Now, I'll give you a little background on myself. I'm a data processing professional, have been for 23 years, and I'm a database administrator, and I'm working on year 2000. In fact, in our hospital, the hospital I work for, I was more or less the spokesperson that got everything going. So I was the one that brought woe and intrigue onto all of management. I want to tell you about data processing, though. You know, everybody's an expert in data processing if you have a computer to some degree. Let me warn you on year 2000. The only experts on year 2000 are the ones that are working on year 2000. So if you go to a data processing expert and they're not working on year 2000, they have no credibility. I'll equate it to, it'd be like a brother writing a paper on the pangs of birth. You know, they just can't relate unless they've been there. Now, I've enjoyed the beautiful colors here. And you know, in Florida, we have one color, green or green, because, of course, we only have two seasons, summer and winter. And guess what? This is winter. So I really enjoyed the colors here. And I understand that they're a little bit subdued this year because you had a dry summer. A wet summer. Well, we had some kind of summer. It was a weather anomaly. And, you know, it kind of reminds me of earlier in the year. In January and February, we had tremendous amounts of rain in Florida, and that's very unusual. That's our dry season. And then in the spring, starting about March until the 1st of July, we basically had no rain at all. We had these tremendous fires, firestorms all through Florida. And fortunately, I don't think anyone was killed, but there was a tremendous effort to subdue these firestorms. And I was thinking, you know, what if someone could have said, you know, next week there's going to be a tremendous fire here. What would people do in preparation? Well, I'm not speaking about literal fire here. I'm speaking about what has been described as a global firestorm on information technology, and it looms on the horizon. It's only 14 and a half months away. And you may have heard of it referred to as the year 2000 problem or the Y2K problem. Now, most of you by now have heard something of it. You probably got something from your bank that said, gee, we're really working on the problem and we're in great shape, or the utilities or the local government. And in fact, that's what the technical professionals are being told now to do, is to inform the public. But we live in a technological society, and whether you have a computer or a personal organizer or a cell phone or any of these devices that use computerized chips or not, you're in a technological society. A number of the brethren have come up to me and said, well, how's it going with the year 2000? Let me answer it this way. About 2 1/4 years ago, I was involved in a project I think we're all familiar with. It's called the Dawn Hymn Book. And I sat in a meeting where we had a combination of musician and data processing people came together, and they did an estimate. And their estimate was, we'll have this thing done in 3 months. And I've been around. I laughed. I thought a year and a half to 2 years. Obviously, I was an optimist as well. And so when you get either musicians or data processing people together, we're eternal optimists. It's not going well. Now, if I knew that 2 weeks from now there was going to be a nor'easter, I'm going to hit, and it's going to give Groton a lot of problems, and all along the coast, you're going to get bad. Wouldn't you want to know? Of course. You know, I'm on the disaster recovery team at the hospital, and preparedness is very important, contingency planning. And I think from a spiritual standpoint, if I can make you aware of some things that are on the horizon that may affect you in the flesh and may affect you potentially in the spirit, I think that's a good thing to let you know, because half the battle is preparing in your mind. What are your contingencies? Now, in Florida, of course, we don't have nor'easters. We have hurricanes. We've got some snowbirds. They come down. See, the snowbirds, their definition, they come down when the hurricanes are not coming into Florida, which is in the winter. And they're smart. Ask Brother Dom. So what we want to do is we're going to look at some things, and we're going to start out looking at some technical things. And this is going to sound like, perhaps you might say, an upgraded version of the second volume, where the pastor goes into a whole lot of, quote, technology items of his day and kind of shows how they show and demonstrate different things. The emphasis of this convention has been on the Apostle Paul. In fact, the Apostle Paul is the one that gives us an admonishment, I think, that is very applicable to this situation we find ourselves in. And this is a admonition we find in 2 Timothy 3:1, and it's talking about the end of the age. Well, where are we, brethren? The end of the age. 2 Timothy 3:1. Know this also, that in the last days perilous times shall come. You know, when we look at this word perilous, it gives us the idea of reducing our strength, of being difficult or dangerous. And by implication, it's kind of a furious state of affairs. When we look at vines, it says this perilous word means hard to deal with, difficult or fierce, hard to pair, painful and grievous. And that's what's being said about the last days. Would you like to have an idea of what you might want to expect? You know, this summer at General Convention, Brother Ray Luke gave an extemporaneous talk. And one of the things that he pointed out was that we are in a period of unprecedented prosperity. For the last 15 years, minus the last couple of months, the economy has been growing, growing, growing. The stock market has been going, going, going. Any of you that are heavily invested know that that sort of changed a couple of months ago. But how long can this go on? What's next? What does this mean to us? And most importantly, what are the forces that will be working against us spiritually? Because, you know, all of this, it's important to get a check every month and all that, but how is this potentially going to affect us spiritually, and how should we react? So our goals this morning are first to acquaint you with some of the things that may come to pass, what it'll mean to us, and how we should approach this. We'll give you a little background. We are in the beginning of the information age, the age that started just a mere 30 years ago. And it's an age that has seen unprecedented growth. According to some estimates, the growth in information and the corresponding growth in wealth has increased over 2,000 times as a result of the information age. This really dwarfs any growth we had between the agricultural and the industrial age. When we went into the information age, wealth increased 2,000-fold. This really ushers in a period we described in Revelation 3:17 called the Laodicean period. This is the period where we're warned in Revelation 3:17, "Thou sayest, I am rich and increased with goods and have no need of nothing, and knowest not that thou art wretched and miserable and poor and blind and naked." This is a caution to the church right now. You know, we think we're not fleshly. And we try not to be fleshly. I mean, we really make an effort. But you know, it was our privilege to be at International Convention this summer. And I got to see a little bit under my own robe. And I got to see a little bit of my own flesh when some of the inconveniences and the non-Western accommodations started to affect us. And I heard murmuring, not only among myself, but among the brethren. This is natural. And it's something that we have to fight against. We are in the period foretold in the 12th chapter of Daniel. Daniel 12:4. "But thou, O Daniel, shut up the words and seal the book even to the time of the end, and many shall run to and fro, and knowledge shall be increased." Are many running to and fro? Look at the airline industry. Record levels. The airlines are the buses of the 90s. Brother David smiling. It's true. I mean, we can literally get on a plane, and within a half a day, we can be in Australia, or we can be in Europe, or we can fly clear across the United States, or not too many hours from now, I can be back in Florida. That's part of that foretold time of increase in knowledge and travel. I have heard a statistic now that knowledge is increasing every 2.5 to 3 years. It used to be 5 years. And a lot of that is due to the collaborative efforts that are available now through this thing we call the internet. It means that knowledge can be shared between Russia, the United States, Australia, South America, collaboratively. So at almost instantaneous rates, we can share massive volumes of information. And from a scientific standpoint, that's a very wonderful thing, because if we have a physicist at the University of FSU in Tallahassee and he wants to collaborate with someone at Los Alamos, he can do it almost immediately. Send them documents. Electronics is the driving force of the information age, just like electricity was the force that caused the maturity of the industrial age. The information age is a result of a little thing called a computer. Some of us carry them around. But know this, the wisdom of this world is foolishness with God. Everybody talks about their latest, greatest computer. That's foolishness. What you have up here is much more impressive. And what you have here, well, there's no comparison. We hope to give you some insights into the basic year 2000 problems, to prove that it is a real problem, to show that you really need to be a little skeptical about what you hear and read, to look at the spiritual challenges and to examine how to stand in the last days. Now, I make no claims to being a prophet and have no special insights, but I will tell you that I have been intimately involved with this. This has been consuming me at work for the last 2.5 years. And I will give you some insights as a consecrated child of God. If you listen to the commentator on the radio or you listen to the person on the Christian station, they're starting to pick up on this, you're not going to get it. I am daily working on this problem, and it is a tremendous problem. It's described as the biggest technical bug in history, and it scares even computer professionals. Now, I don't know how many of you know Faith Clark. She's somewhere out in the Midwest. I saw her at General Convention, and she's in computers. And I said, are you working on the year 2000 problem? You know what her response was? I'm avoiding it like the plague. And that's what I find with data processing professionals. If they can, they stay away from it because they know it's bad news. So what's the nature of the problem? Well, since the dawn of the computer age, most computers have represented the year portion of dates as 2 digits. And this is a bug that's built into both the hardware and software of many computers. When the computer says 98, we think 1998. When the computer says 99, we think 1999. When the computer says 00, we think 2000. But many of the computers think 1900. And this is what we describe as the year 00 or the uh-oh problem. What's the big deal? Well, when it comes to calculations, time is money. And by inference, time is affected by dates. Do you care about your money? There is a big difference, a significant difference between 2000 and 1900. I was at a disaster recovery conference about 1.5 years ago in Miami, and I met with some representatives from Pacific Bell. See, I can tell this story because we're on the East Coast. And they were testing some of their telephone switches. That's the thing that either monitors your cellular phone calls or your long-distance calls, and it calculates how much time you spend and so on and so forth. And so they ran a test on one of their switches, and it came up with a telephone bill that was over $5 million for a 2-minute call over the year 2000. Still think it's not a problem? What's the year 2000 problem? Everybody asks me this, and I say, you're asking the wrong question. What are the year 2000 problems? Now, you might say, well, Brother Bob, I'm not technical. I don't have a computer. I get the same question from technicians. This is the reason, by the way, I'm going to Australia on a business conference, is to talk on year 2000. Try to help them out a little bit. There are actually at least 5 distinct different problems. The first one is date representation. We kind of talked about that. That's the 00 versus 2000 kind of problem. And that can be manifest on reports or on whatever. The next is a date rollover problem. There's an awful lot of computers, especially personal computers, that will not properly roll over from December 31st, 1999 to January 1st, 2000. In fact, they will roll over to January 4th, 1980. And that's due to some computer stuff. But anyway, that's another problem. If your computer doesn't have the right date in it, it's not going to give your program the right date, all sorts of problems. The other thing we pointed out was date math and date spans. An awful lot of what we do in computers, whether it be in hospitals or utilities or insurance, is we calculate periods, and we calculate the number of days between this date and this date, or we say the next payday is this, all of those types of things. Date math. Another problem that Bill Gates is well aware of is that the year 2000 is a leap year. The reason he's aware of that is he testified before Congress last year that all of his products were compliant. And then he had to go back this year and say, oh, by the way, Windows NT, my premier operating system for the enterprise, doesn't know that year 2000 is a leap year. The uh-oh problem. And if you don't calculate that it's a leap year, you also probably forget the day of week after February 29th, 2000. You see what I mean? It's not just one problem, it's multiples. And so when I talk to technical professionals, we have to really educate them because they have to know what to test for. It's not just one simple problem. Add to that the fact that the computer can be corrupted at many levels. The hardware, that's the computer itself. That's the machine that you can put your hands on. The operating system, that's kind of the thing that allows all of your software to run. That'd be like your Windows 95. The middleware, your programming languages and databases and whatever you use. You have applications, your email and your word processing, all of those things. And finally, the interfaces, like your internet access and so on and so forth. And what we see, you can think of this like a giant silicon sandwich. Now we can ask the sisters, if you have a sandwich and you have five different fixings in it, and I pass you some turkey that has salmonella, and you make all the sandwiches for the convention and you lay them out on the table, and now we find out there's salmonella, what do you do? Well, if you're a man, you probably pull the meat out, but of course the sisters would be a little wiser, and they would say it's corrupted the whole thing. And that's exactly what happens in this silicon sandwich that we're talking about. It can be corrupted at any one of these levels. And with regards to interfaces, which is external talking back and forth, you can be corrupted from the outside. What a wonderful thought. To make matters worse, computers are networked so that corruption can occur at a corporate level. Any of you that have work for companies that have had a virus hit your computer network know this all too well. And the year 2000 bug, these bad dates can infiltrate your entire computer system and your entire network in much the same way. Sounds complicated, doesn't it? It is. Trust me. Even most computer technicians do not understand. Let me give you an example. I had a brother come up to me and say, well, you know, Brother Bob, I've got my little teller card. Oops, well, that's not a teller card. But everyone's got a bank card. And you go to the machine and said, well, why won't that work? The bank told me their computers work. Well, it's not quite that easy. Let me tell you what's involved in that transaction. First of all, there's a magnetic card reader, and it's going to read your stripe. Then there's actually a mini computer, a microcomputer right there, that's going to do a certain amount of validation and talk to the main host computer. Then you have microprocessor sensors there as well, right? Is the card in or out? You have power. You have telephone lines. Even though they're not on public lines, they're on a private banking network. It's still over Southern New England Telephone, Bell South, whatever. Okay, still goes over the phone lines, the banking network itself, and the host computer. Once again, this is just like the silicon sandwich. It can break at any one of these levels. When you hear someone claim, I've got the fix, don't believe them. No one has the fix. A lot of people have a fix for a particular problem or a particular platform or so forth. But in business today, like a large bank, our hospital has many, many kinds of PCs. We have a large network. It's very intricate. We have numerous mid-range processors, and we've got even a couple of mainframes. So if I create and sculpt a solution for one platform, it has to be done again for the next and the next and the next. And then the really hard thing is, how do you test all of these things together? You know, even the banking people that I've talked to on testing and fixing have conceded that they cannot actually test their networks. Can't do it. In Orlando, we have the Honor Network, which I think expands up here as well. They're one of the largest networks in the country. And I asked, how are you doing your year 2000 testing? And then what they told me was they are taking representative samples of their equipment, creating a separate network and testing that way. And that's pretty good. That's step one. Step two is the real thing. And you can't do it because the network's never down. 2 o'clock in the morning, I can go get money. 3 o'clock in the morning, when do you put the network down? Can't do it in this 24-hour day world in which we live. This is the largest data processing project ever undertaken. Talking to David Bushy, there is a vice president of year 2000 for Delta Airlines. You think it's important? There are literally trillions of lines of source code which must be reviewed and fixed before this can be solved. And like most data processing projects, just like the songbook, we're very optimistic and we're very behind. For the wisdom of this world is foolishness to God. He taketh the wise in their own craftiness. I think we've created a wonderful, efficient, high-tech society. And I have to imagine, I know God's got a sense of humor. I have to imagine he's chuckling just a little bit about what's been done. Oh, we're so wise, and yet we've worked ourselves in this corner. But computers aren't the only problem. You know, we listed computers, but embedded microprocessors are the real problem. And they come in all sorts and forms. The last one I had, I lost because it's so small, but this one's in a card, so I haven't lost this yet. But there's our friend, the embedded microprocessor. And these things are everywhere. You know, on a business trip, I can pull out a cell phone, a pager, a smart card, you name it, my computer, so on and so forth. These little embedded processors are everywhere. They're cheap. They're embedded in devices so that devices can have behaviors. Anybody got a Mr. Coffee that wakes you up in the morning, kind of makes your coffee? All of these wonderful conveniences that we have are brought to you via the microprocessor. They're found in virtually everything. From if you have a wristwatch you don't wind that has a battery, it's got a microprocessor in it. They're everywhere. In our hospital, we have a $4 million budget next year for computer remediation for year 2000. Our budget for embedded microprocessors, we have a lot of biomedical equipment, started out at $26 million. So when you look at the computer part of this, you're looking at the tip of the iceberg. In fact, the nice thing about the computers is, if that program sends out bad bills, I can go in, get the code, and fix it so next week it sends out good bills. But with these little guys, you can't usually do that. Microprocessors are everywhere. Watches, pocket organizers, smart cards, beepers, cell phones. Oh, I don't have my keys, but you know that little device on my key on my new car has a security. It has a microprocessor chip in it. The car will start but not continue to run unless you have that microprocessor talking to the one in the car. You get the point? They're everywhere. My kids have gotten them in watches and calculators and cereal boxes based on our friend the microprocessor. They're cheap. They're in everything. The average car today, this is a question often asked, is controlled by more than 50 microprocessors. Fortunately, Detroit tells us that they won't be affected by the year 2000. Microprocessors are highly pervasive in this high-tech society. In 1995, there were 3.5 billion microprocessors. 1996, that jumped to 6 billion. 1997, 7 billion. And by the year 2000, there will be over 25 billion microprocessors out in our high-tech environment. And the scary thing is, we don't even know where they all are. Why? Microprocessors have even invaded the lowly birthday card. Still think you won't be affected? Fortunately, with regards to these little guys, only about 3% of these really care about what day of week it is or the date. Unfortunately, a little bit of leaven leaveneth the whole lump. So with regards to things like the telephone system and the power grid, this can be really catastrophic if you have a 3% failure rate. These are very difficult to test. There's a lot of problems. And there, our choice of remediation with our hospital, with all of our biomedical equipment, is normally replacement. So you can't really fix them. You have to replace them. So what happens when things break? Well, we had a recent AT&T network router problem that knocked out long distance for the Northeast and big piece of the United States for a major part of 2 days. Pretty significant. Satellite failure knocked out 95% of all beepers earlier this year. The problem at the Hong Kong airport is crippling their entire economy. And then, of course, we see things like the markets in Tokyo and the financial collapse in the Soviet Union. All of these things give us little glimpses of the type of things that can happen when we have technology failures. So is this real? I will tell you yes, and I will give you four proofs. First of all, spending. Large businesses are spending more than 22% of their information technology budgets this year on the effort. It's estimated that will rise to 56% of their technology budgets next year. It is expected that the total cost for year 2000 correction originally started out at $600 billion with a B dollars, and it's up to $2 trillion now by some estimates. Litigation is likely to add another $1 to $2 trillion. Another thing that shows it, testing. We tested our systems at a disaster recovery. At the end of the test, we turned the clock ahead to see what would happen. And we had written a system that was designed with year 2000 in mind. We found 83 problems in 2.5 hours. Within 2 months, we had a $4 million budget. Before then, we had $0. Testing proves it out. In the Hawaiian Electrical Co-op, they did a test of their electrical grid. They set the clock ahead, and they had isolated one segment and one power plant to see what the likely effects would be. Within 15 seconds, that plant went down and knocked down the entire electrical grid. Year 2000 problem. Press coverage is another way that we can know that it's real. We've seen many defects from the Windows NT defect. A number of airlines have announced they will not be flying on December 31st, 1999, including KLM, an Australian carrier, and several U.S. carriers have alluded to the fact that they may not fly. There are also a number of, there's been press coverage of a number of lawsuits that are going. One, which I'm kind of aware of, is a product called Medical Manager. It's one that helps doctors manage their medical practices. And there are 5 class action suits currently going on against this company because they're selling software as late as this time last year that's not year 2000 compliant. Study. Let me give you a recent study on New York City. This is, so to speak, hitting close to home. Here was a study that was paid for by the city of New York to predict the impact of year 2000 on its operations. As a result of this, the governor of the state of New York has banned all non-essential computer projects to work on year 2000. And the study is as follows. The electrical supply will be available only 50% of the time during the first 10 days of January. Hospitals will have emergency room only in New York for the first 4 weeks. Schools will be closed for a month. The stock market and banks will be closed for 8 days. The phone system will be only 50% available during the first 10 days. Air, bus, and rail will experience severe disruptions for the first 30 days. And there will be widespread disruptions in New York City for the first 10 days of January. This is what the expert consultants that came in from the outside and looked at their preparedness predicted. They also did a study of London. They fared much worse. In fact, worldwide, the awareness here is fairly high. I would venture to say that most of you have received something in the mail that says, we're working on year 2000. Feel good about us. When we went to Hungary, I was amazed basically a third world country, that we went to a little grocery store. They had barcode readers and cash registers. They had computers everywhere, and yet no idea of what was looming on the horizon. The wisdom of this world is foolishness to God. We've looked at, there's a number of trends that have accentuated this problem: mergers and acquisitions, business alliances and partnerships, downsizing and right-sizing, re-engineering, automation, productivity enhancements, robotics, integration, economies of scale, just-in-time everything, electronic data interchange, electronic business, free market economies, and global economics. All of these things, you know, this sounds like something from the business school, right, Brother Paul? All of these things are based on one thing: profit. We would term it a little different. Apostle Paul gave us this in 1 Timothy 6:10. For the love of money is the root of all evil. And the whole motive for all of these efficiencies is to increase profits. This has been a motivator throughout time. So what is the failure, the spectrum of failure? Well, I can tell you with a fair degree of assurance that there will be major problems in the year 2000. The worldwide expert on this, Peter DeJager, has equated it to a semi-truck coming, running at a wall at 100 miles an hour, and we're trying to decide when we want to put the brakes on. And in his assessment now, it's too late. We're going to hit the wall. I painted a very scary picture. Anybody nervous? Anybody anxious? This does paint a scary picture. And I'm going to tell you, brethren, you're going to hear a lot more about this in 1999. Warner Communications has purchased the Peter DeJager story rights. And they're going to come out with a wonderful disaster movie in November of 1999. And if you'll excuse the expression, it's going to scare the bejeebers out of everybody. In fact, there's a lot of concern that there may be panic. Now, I will tell you that you need to be a little skeptical about the optimistic message you may be getting, because there's lots of money behind this. But what should our approach be to this? We know that the wisdom of this world is foolishness, and quite frankly, I'm the only year 2000 experts that's going to come up here and tell you this is a whole lot of nothing. So got your anxiety up about a whole lot of nothing. But did I make you anxious? You know, when I read and go out and research on this, it gets me anxious. What we're seeing there, though, is not the eyes of the Spirit, but the eyes of the flesh. And that's important to realize. You know, this is like a disaster. They tell me that if you prepare for a hurricane and you're riding out a hurricane and you know what to expect, you know when you go into the eye that it gets quiet and so forth, that the experience is much easier to take. How can we stand in this time? Well, the Apostle Paul tells us this, and I appreciate the theme of this convention. And we'll give you five keys to standing. First, he says, stand in faith, 1 Corinthians 16:13. Watch ye and stand in the faith, quit you like men. Be strong. Secondly, put on the whole armor of Christ. Wherefore, take ye the whole armor of God, that ye may be able to withstand in that evil day, having done all to stand. Ephesians 6:13. Stand fast in the Spirit. Philippians 1:27. Let your conversation be as it becometh the gospel of Christ, that whether I come and see you or else be absent, I may hear of your affairs, that ye stand fast in one spirit, with one mind, striving together for the faith of the gospel. Stand fast in the will of God. Colossians 4:12. Always laboring fervently for you in prayers, that ye stand perfect and complete in all the will of God. You know, this is kind of like that definition of humility. You're focused on God's will. You kind of forget about and minimize some of these things that are affecting you. Stand in the power of God, Colossians 2:5, that your faith should not stand in wisdom of man, but in the power of God. Is anybody nervous here about the stock market? I mean, everyone's got a 401k or some kind of investment in the market, perhaps. Does that give you anxiety? It gives my flesh anxiety, but you know, we have a battle going on here. The old man and the new creature. As one wanes, the other one grows. It's important as we go through turbulent times, and many of us have gone through problems with health. Brother Larry wasn't here because of a problem in his family with health. We've all had these issues touch our lives. And we learn to stand in the Lord and to look to Him. But we as a society, not in recent history, how many went through the Depression? Well, there's a memory here. But we in this society, this high-tech, fast-paced society, are not used to going in want. This is going to be a trial. We could give you all sorts of advice on year 2000. The only advice that's legitimate is spiritual. Think about the five ways in which we can stand. And be prepared, as the scout saying goes. Be prepared. There's a storm on the horizon. Do you want to prepare? Yeah, you can make some preparations physically, but prepare spiritually. And let me give you a challenge, because I think we have a wonderful witness opportunity. You know, one of the things that we do in Orlando is when there's an event, we kind of quickly tailor a witness, and then we put it out in the paper. And I think that's a good thing. So we had the fires, and we put out a witness. Well, here's an event that we all know is coming. And we kind of know the nature of what's going to happen and the potential's there. So we have a wonderful opportunity to witness to the glory of God. Tell the brethren of the upcoming crisis. Tell the brethren of the dangers looming on the horizon. Tell the brethren for the opportunities for spiritual growth. Tell the brethren about this crisis. And you know, when we have the word crisis, I like the Chinese symbol for it. It's two symbols, danger and opportunity. To the flesh, this is a danger. Spiritually, this is a wonderful opportunity. It's going to be a proving opportunity for each and every one of us. Tell the brethren they need to stand in faith. Tell the brethren they need to put on the whole armor of God. Tell the brethren to stand fast in the Spirit. Tell the brethren to depend on the arm and the power of God. Tell the brethren, don't depend on earthly wisdom. Depend on things above. Tell the brethren of the necessity of being tried in the fire. In the same way our dear Apostle Paul told the brethren in his day of all the woes and afflictions that he had succumbed to, and yet he was victorious. 1 Peter 1:7, that the trial of your faith, being more precious than of gold that perisheth, though it be tried with fire, might be found unto the praise and the honor and the glory at the appearing of our Lord Jesus Christ. 3 years from now, what's your testimony going to be about how you handle the year 2000 crisis? As children of God, we should look at this as an opportunity, because each and every one of us prays for the full establishment of the kingdom. It is even at the door. Let us diligently approach these perilous times with spiritual thoughts and preparation. Whether this is a minor birth pang or a major birth pang, we really can't say. But we do need a sense of urgency. And I think this is one crisis that may help us along those lines. Let us keep in mind that the time is short. 14 months, 2 weeks. Let us maintain spiritual focus. Let us not be as our neighbors. Let us plan a wonderful witness to the glory of God. Luke 21:28. And when these things begin to come to pass, then look up and lift your heads, for your redemption draweth nigh. For from him and through him and to him are all things. To him be the glory forever. Amen.
He wound up by saying, let us maintain spiritual focus. First he scares us to death, and then he gives us the admonition. Have you ever heard of this expression? I'm laughing on the inside and crying on the outside and laughing on the inside. You understand what I mean? Oh, how was it, Stella? Have you ever heard that expression? I'm laughing on the outside and crying on the inside. And you know, if it's merely for profit, then greed comes in. When greed comes in, friends, this is part of the great time of trouble. Is that right? We're at the end of the age, friends. It's a great time of trouble. Bear up your faith. Should I tell them to get rid of the money in the bank or throw those stocks down? Because the scriptures tells us your money's no good. Boy, we're going to need the faith. Let me tell you something, friends. If you think we've seen something now, we ain't seen nothing. Is that right, Diane? You're laughing, right? But keep the faith. That was a good talk, Bob. I appreciate it. I don't understand too much of this computer system. And I don't want to. I don't need to. At my stage, Paul is laughing. He can have the problems. He can have the work.